Remember, our format says 45 minutes, John, okay?
My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. You know, many times when I'm asked to speak, particularly out of town, I get the impression that I have so much time to prepare, and mentally in my mind I'm thinking that I haven't done enough drinking and I'd better go out and get a fast drunk so I can really come up with stories. And tonight, all I wanted to do when he asked me about 5 minutes ago if I would be willing to speak, all I wanted to do, frankly, is run. It's easy to talk outside of this valley. It's very easy to talk to a group of total strangers. It's something entirely different to speak with somebody that I know as well as I know in this group and love as much as I do love this people. I has a young man sitting in front of me who I'm going to be giving a medallion, maybe we'll give a medallion a little later on, said to me, he said, since you're sitting behind me, that means I can't heckle the speaker. And I looked at him with a deadly glint and said, they're goddamn right you're not going to heckle the speaker. And for those of you who feel so inclined, we'll have a 5 minute break so you can leave. I introduce myself as an alcoholic, and everything that I can and will say from this particular podium this evening will be based solely and exclusively upon my life experiences and the things that I have learned since I have been in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I came here not knowing most of the things that I do know today, and almost everything I brought into the fellowship had to be thrown away because I had to start from scratch. I was told that the old ideas and the things that I brought in here did not work, and that's basically a very true statement. I came into my first meeting, and not through my own knowledge and not necessarily through anything that I really know about. I am so excited about the fellowship of AA, and I have been almost from my first meeting. But my first meeting, as many of you have heard, and unfortunately many of you have heard much of what it is that I have to offer, but I only have the story that I have, and I can't invent shit like I used to. My last drunk was in this valley, and it was by a young man who worked for me. I had loaned him enough money to buy a car because his money was tied up in a divorce settlement. He came by my office on a Friday, and he said to me, he said, John, the divorce is over. I can pay you back, and let's go celebrate. He was already drinking, and he was way ahead of me, and I rushed like a sucker just to catch up with him, and I was successful. That particular night, we did a lot of strange things, I think. I know that we had built a new home over by Lee High School, and I had a bedspread to pick up. And I remember being obsessed with picking this bedspread up, and it was at Bruner's. And we would go to some place, and drink some stuff, and then we would agree to meet at another bar, and I would go pick up the bedspread. But Bruner's kept moving that night. And I would meet him at this next place, and we would decide on another place to go, and then I'd go get the goddamn bedspread. And it was moved again. It's one of those, you know, the reason I commented about it, it was just one of those drunks. There was nothing special about that particular drunk. I remember getting in a health spa somebody in some place, somewhere in the eucalyptus room, and telling someone and preaching to this one about this poor sucker that I had nailed into the corner of the evils of drink. And I went home like I more times than not wound up. I slept on my couch, which was my favorite resting place. It was far too cold in the bedroom. The Ice Queen's domain. And so I slept in this very comfortable couch, which I had grown accustomed to. And around 3-4 o'clock, my daughter woke me up and said, Daddy, Bob is in jail and he wants you to come bail him out. And I did what I have always done. So when I got into any kind of a difficulty like that, I would scream to myself in my own way and say, Jesus Christ, the fools in this world that cannot hold their booze. That simple shit. I did not like people, and I was trying desperately to stay away from them. I don't know how many times this guy would come over to our house, and I would tell Peggy, I would say to her, "What the hell does he want? He keeps calling me friend. What does he want?" I did not know that he was put in my life to save my life. Because I went and bailed him out that particular night or that particular day, and he knew something about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. His father was in it, and he went to an AA meeting. And he started grinding on me. And I had figured out what my problem was. If you be periodic, and I am, and was, and can be again, is that you go out and you drink all you can till you can't drink anymore, and then you sober up, and then you figure out what you had done wrong. And then if you've got it figured out, then you start tapering in on your next drunk. And I was tapering in, and it was on a Thursday night. And it was on March the 11th, and it was 1976. And I had had a few drinks, and my friend came by after an AA meeting. And he told me about you and how beautiful this place was. And I agreed to come to a meeting just to check you guys out. I did not come back, or I did not come see you until Tuesday, which was the 16th of March, 1976, I was 4 days without a drink or a pill, and I walked into my first meeting, and the very first person I met, I want you to know, the very first person I met insulted me. God, you guys were cold and crude and uncivilized in that meeting. I had the privilege of being called on in that meeting, and the best I had to offer was I had come to find out what the creeps do on a Tuesday night. And I had found out, you're all a bunch of creeps. The second man I met insulted me too. He inferred that I did not have enough guts to stay sober for 90 days. And I got mad. And I went home and I told my wife about how cruelly they treated me. I bought the book. We discussed the book. We talked about the weird people that I saw that night and the sickness that was just running through that room. And God, if I had problems like those people had, I too probably would have to get sober. My wife had this foolish Al-Anon belief, and I don't know where she got it, just because my wife and daughter were both all excited, just because I had gone to the meeting and I admitted to myself that I wasn't admitted to the room that I'd be alcoholic. They had this insane idea that I was never going to drink again. And I hadn't even made up my mind. I know that a few days passed and my friend called me, and it was on a Friday, and he said, "Do you want to go to a meeting?" And I said to him, "Why?" He said, "Well, there are good stuff there, and come on down." And I said, finally reluctantly agreed to go to that meeting with him. And I found that the quality of the people were infinitely better than the quality of people that were at that Tuesday night meeting. They were a little more friendly and they said nicer things, and no one insulted me. My friend called me on the following Tuesday and said, "You want to go to a meeting?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to see if those suckers are any better." And I went there, and they were so much better. They were so much better. They were kind, and they were smiling, and no one insulted me. And my friend called me on the following Friday, and he said, "You want to go to a meeting?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I'd like to." And I went in there, and the light was on, and the people were shiny, and they were bright, and I was so excited about this thing. And I called my friend on a Saturday and said, "You want to go to a meeting?" And he said, "No, I don't want to." And I've been going to meetings, not alone, but I've been going to meetings ever since because I fell in love with you. And in the process of falling in love with you, I say, and I've been saying it, and I hope that I shall always say it, from the moment I walked into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous to this day, the quality of my life has gotten better. The quality of my life has gotten better. As the result of coming to you and finding out what message you had to offer me, everything that is of any value to me, everything that is of any value to me was given to me by coming here. And I didn't even find you. I couldn't find you by myself. I remember there was a number of newcomers in this particular meeting, and I would address some of this to those of you who might be just where I was in those early days of my sobriety. I come to these meetings and I saw what it is that you had to offer. I could not relate to your drunkenness. But the way of life appealed to me so strongly. it appeared to me that if you really, really were telling the truth, then you had something working for you that I didn't have, and I wanted it, and I didn't have any idea what it was. And you said, don't drink in between meetings, and come to us, and you can have this thing. And I believed that, and so I didn't drink. But I knew full well that it was no big goddamn deal. I had never tried not drinking in my life, and I felt it was relatively easy to do. But then after a period of time, the sickness set in, and I said to myself, I don't belong here. Because I started listening to you. And I started finding out that I couldn't relate to you. And I said that I don't belong. And I started to pull back. And I think about that. And I think of the many people who have come to this fellowship. And they do not identify. And they say, oh, I don't belong here. Because you see, I was as honest as I could be. And I don't subscribe to the fact that I can lie to myself. I certainly have subscribed to the fact that I'm full of self-deception. But I can't know what I don't know, and I can't hear what I cannot hear. And when I got here, I could not hear you. I could see you, and I could feel you, but I could not hear you. And as a result of that, I came within an inch of walking out. And I think of the people who do the same thing that I did, and unfortunately don't come back that extra day for the magic to happen, because I came back that extra day and the magic happened to me. And the magic happened to me when I read in the 12 by 12 where it talks about, since the book was written, how many people found that they could get off or come in at a much earlier rate. And I said that there is a chance. That's when I heard that you can get off at any time. You see, up until then, I still did not have a drunk log. When you were asking me a question about my past, I had to lie to you. And the reason I had to lie to you, because I felt I had to belong. I did not know what I did not know, and I did not have a drunk alone. I got obsessed with you. I got obsessed with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got obsessed with the teachings of a wonderful man by the name of Chuck C. And it wasn't that I did not understand what you said, nor is it not that I did not understand what the book said, nor that I did not understand what Chuck said. I needed to know what you meant by what you said. I needed to know what was underneath all that. I think that, I don't know where this thing came from, but it says in our 12 and 12, and when it talks about in our 11th step prayer and meditation, it talks about sitting in that quiet beach, and it talks about listening and repeating the prayer of St. Francis and trying to find out, what did the man really mean by what he said? And that's what I was trying to do, is find out, what did you really mean by what you said? I came up to my wife after a few months in sobriety, and I felt good. Oh, God, I felt good. And I felt good almost from my first meeting. I walked up to her, and I said, this is strange, honey. And she said, what? I said, you know, this house and everybody in it seem to be so happy, and we aren't having any problems, and I feel so good, and I'm afraid. And she said, what are you afraid of? And I said, because I'm changing. There's big things happening in my life, and I'm on to something here, and I don't know what's happening, but I'm changing, and I am afraid of what's happening to me, because I don't know what's going to happen when I continue this thing, and I cannot stop. And she said to me, one of the many important things that I've heard in my life, and she said, don't worry, you're changing into the kind of man that I've always known you were. Now, I don't know where she got that information, because I didn't know what kind of a man I was, nor do I necessarily know what I am now. I know the origin of me, and I know what I really am, and what I am today, I found out through you, is that I am a child of God. I kept coming to meetings, and I kept listening to you, and I kept identifying, and I kept studying. And I went to a meeting. I went down to in San Diego. The Great Hand of Alcoholics Anonymous is always about. And I was afraid. I was going down to San Diego for a bowling tournament, and I was 4 months sober, about 4.5 months sober. And I was going down there, and the guys on my bowling team, because I bowled in with a bunch of hot shots, and we did a powerful amount of drinking, they just loved to talk about me on my drunks on the bowling tournaments that occurred outside of the state tournaments throughout any city that we went to. We'd been doing this for years. And I was all, when all else failed, you need to tell a story. You ought to tell what Carney did on the down back in Modesto or where it was in Oxnard and the weird shit that he pulled. And I'm a little bit afraid because this is my first exposure to really out of town stuff and I don't know. And you know how this thing goes. And I'm looking for, what do I have enough not to drink like I've always drank? This was perhaps my first challenge. And I'm on an airplane. And I'm going down here and kind of, you know, I'm squirming inside of me and I'm wondering what the hell is going on. And the miracles of Alcoholics Anonymous are so great and the fellowship is so outstanding. Is there I am sitting on this airplane and I'm squirming in my seat knowing full well my moment of doom is about me. And somebody taps me on the arm. And I look up. And there's Johnny O. At 30,000 feet, saying, "The eyes of Alcoholics Anonymous are on you." You can't drink behind that shit. You just can't do it. You got to stay sober because you don't know what's going to happen when you're coming back on the airplane. Who's going to be there? Anyway, I went down to San Diego, and what happened to me is I got overconfident after my first night there, and I was out on my second night, and I was in a saloon where I should not have been, and I was careless, and I was smart, and I was arrogant, and I was all of those things that I am. And they were manifested themselves in what I can only tell you that we talk about in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, a moment of clarity. My moment of clarity was 2.5 hours of absolute hell. The gates of hell opened up, and the fire came out. And I could see those things that I could never see before. I knew now why it was that my children had cut and run from me. They'd gone to visit and stayed permanently. They couldn't wait to get out of my house. And my children that I loved and adored beyond belief, how they were afraid of me. And my little medical miracle, my son who was 8 years old at the time, who I treasured his relationship, was always in the other room when I came home, and I knew about that. And I knew the things that I did not know before I got here. I knew what it was to be and how it was that my people were afraid of me. And the things that alcoholism had done to me, it was all given to me in those 2.5 hours of absolute hell. My wife had bought me a chain there, and I talk about this chain from time to time. My wife that day had bought me this because I was very fit and very spiritual. When you're 4 months sober, you're just... I had absolutely reached the stage where I could talk in AA meetings. And the fact that people would listen to me was enough to make me float. But Peggy had bought to this because I was so spiritual. She had bought it for the cross, and I was willing to accept the cross, although I didn't know what the hell it meant. And we were in this 2.5 hours of hell, and what was happening to me there is that it was agonizing. I was going crazy. I wanted to kill. And I have done that. I wanted to drink. And I have certainly done that. I wanted to hurt people. And I certainly have done that. And I wanted to die. And I have done that. And I was going crazy. And I had this chain and I kept tangling my hand in it just as I'm doing right now. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous and the life of is not made out of necessarily big things. And spiritual awakenings don't necessarily all come in powerful flashes of light. Spiritual awakenings in the spiritual life that is mine today comes in very simple things. And this is what I was doing because I knew that if I could get both hands loose, I was going to hurt somebody bad. And I could scream to myself as only an alcoholic could scream. I would scream to myself and I would say, "Oh God, if I could only live through this without killing anybody and without hurting anybody and without drinking. I know and I have the information so that I can process myself through these 12 steps of recovery." Because I had a glimpse of a God of my very own at that particular meeting or at that particular time. And so my hand never came out of this thing, and it was tangled in this. And when I keep thinking that here it is, this is 13 and a half years later, and when I do this, I do this all the time. I think to myself, as I've thought from that day, what would have happened had I not had the chain? And then I think, what would have happened if it had been perhaps an expensive chain with a link in it that would have broken? But it didn't. It, like Alcoholics Anonymous, is a circle of love. It did not break because it had no weak link in it. I came back from San Diego, and I was rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence, which I refer to as the spiritual way of life. I started working the 12 steps of recovery, and in an amazingly short period of time, God, in his infinite wisdom, has seemed to have made it possible for me to make amends to all of the people that were on my list. I drank alcohol for 30 years, and I did it in I don't know how many states, but in the period of time, and I got to give an illustration of how it was for me. And it wasn't, please understand that it's not that I can claim any credit for it. I was running away, please, running away from the absolute gates of hell. I was catapulted in a force so much stronger than anything I had ever known, took control of my life, and started doing things for me that I absolutely could not do for myself. And I roared through the first 7 steps of recovery. I wrote my list, and I went to my sponsor, and I gave him the list. But I couldn't even do that fast enough, because almost immediately the people on my list started appearing in front of my face. I'm going crazy with this thing. Every time I turn around, somebody is on my list. My kids are calling me. I'm awarded I was asked by my son-in-law, my brother-in-law, to write a letter to help my nephew who I owed an amends, who was going to go to jail. I wrote a goddamn letter trying to ease the judgment of the court and show you how God did. The first thing he did is he awarded me the child. My wife and I got the custody of the kid, for Christ's sake. You got to be careful what you do in this outfit. You know, I'm all through. I've gone through all my list of my ninth step. I'm all through with it. I walk up to Peg and I said, I've done everything. And she said, you mean you made every amends to everybody? And I said, yes. And she said, well, I got some people too. And the lights went on. And I suddenly realized, oh, you mean I've missed a few people? And she said, yes. And she gave me the name. We were in a bowling alley. And it shows you the coincidence. And we were in a bowling alley. It was at Cambrian Bowl, and we live over by Lee High School. And she said, I have a list, and what about David C.? And I said, oh, my God, how could I have missed him? You see, I had difficulties with this young man. And one day I loaded up a pistol, and I went out to blow his goddamn head off. And he wasn't there. And then I talked to him on a telephone a little later on, and I told him very sweetly and very humbly and oh so sincerely that you better look over your shoulder for the rest of your life, because if you don't see me first, you're dead. And I forgot him. And Peggy told me about that, and I said, oh, Lord, now I'm going to have to find this little bastard. We go home, and the telephone is ringing, and when the telephone is done, it's my daughter, and my daughter lived in Nebraska at that time. And we chatted for a few minutes, and this is part of the overwhelming things that have occurred in my life. And she said to me, she was talking about sobriety and how my life was going. And I said to her, honey, I'm finishing my ninth step. And there's a David C. is on the list. And do you happen to know where he is? Because I haven't seen him in about 7 or 8 or 9 years. She said, yes, I do, Daddy. Why? And I said, well, honey, I have to make an amends to him. She said, oh, well, just a minute. He's standing right beside me. And that is the way it has been for me. I have a dedication to the great love of my life, and the great love of my life is Alcoholics Anonymous. You see, I was sitting in a meeting, and after the meeting, it was at St. Luke's, and for those of you who have met and seen my lady and I together, she is such a key and vital part of my sobriety. Notice that We got a deal going between the two of us, and it's a very successful relationship. It has not always been that way, but it certainly has turned into that. And my lady, I was sitting there at St. Luke's, and a group of people of Al-Anons came up to me, and they said, John, somebody was down in the AA meeting, and they said that their wife was the second most important thing in your life. And since you and Peggy are so devoted and you are so happy, we thought we'd come up and ask you where Peggy is in your life. And I thought for half a second. And I said, well, I hate to tell you this. And they said, why? I said, well, she's the fourth most important thing in my life. And they were dumbfounded, and so was I. I wanted to wash my mouth out with soap because I didn't believe that's the way you had a relationship. I was totally and irrevocably convinced that if you had a lady in your life, she had to be the most important thing there was. And since I have made the mistake from the moment I got sober, from my first night to this, I have made the mistake of sharing with my wife. I went home to her. And God, you have to realize my life has never been better. And I was absolutely terrified because I had to walk up to her with all the humility that I did not have and tell her, I got something to tell you. And she said, what? I said, you're no longer number one in my life. And I waited. And she didn't leave or hit me. And then she said, thank God. You see, I didn't know it until then. But I had married a hostage, and she didn't know she was one. And that's a bitch. For 15 and a half years, I was trying to make this woman the single most important woman in my life and single most important thing in my life, and she didn't want it. And what a relief from responsibility. And then she asked me, why do you say I'm only number one or number four? And I told her the awareness that I had, and it's still the awareness that I have today, and I would pass it on to you because it's so vitally important to me. I was told that I could not get sober, nor could I stay sober unless sobriety became the single most important thing in my entire life. And that is true. And what happened to me is one day I did not take a drink. And because of not taking that drink, because I don't think I could have come here if I had drank that day, the first and single most important thing of my life is that I do not take a drink today. Because once I did not take that drink, I came to you. And because I came to you, you gave me a program of recovery. And this program of recovery led me to a God of my very own. And so the order by which I rank things in my life is I don't drink today. And I come to you with a program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I deal with a God of my very own. And after that, and only after that, did I have those things that are mine today. The quality and the glory that is truly mine. I have had so much awareness since I have been sober. I have realized that the finger of God had been working in my life long, long before I got sober. Long before I got sober. I have no idea of the revelations that were occurred. But I'm talking about this thing about the chain is a vital and important thing. But it's one of the many links that I do not know that existed that caused me to get here and caused you to come here. I don't know what your sequence of events were. But one of the things, I was talking once again to my daughter who was in Nebraska. And I was telling her, honey, do you know what's happening? And she said, what? She said, well, I'm in the program of recovery of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm going to 12-stepper across thousands of miles of everything, because, Jesus, nobody was safe in front of me in those days. They're not too safe today. And she said, Daddy, I'm so grateful. She said, can I tell you something? And I said, yes. She said, well, a couple months ago, a group of us decided to start a Bible study class. And I said to her, oh, that's wonderful. Everyone should get to know their Creator. And she said, yeah, but Daddy, but before we started that Bible study class, we all got together and decided to find some poor soul to pray for. And you won. And for those of you who doubt the power of prayer, I want you to know it works at least from Nebraska to California. That is the way it has been for me. There are many, many means by which it is that I got here, and very few of them had anything to do with me. Because all I've been looking for, frankly, is less than I have today. And I repeat that because I've never heard it before. Everything I've ever wanted in life was less than I had today. Much less than I had today. I was sitting in the asshole of creation, which is a town called Fresno. It was 9 years before I got here. And it was the lowest part of my entire life. And when I say that, I mean I was totally and absolutely irrevocably beaten. Now, that doesn't mean that I had not had other difficulties that were perhaps even more insane, because quite a number of years ago, I had gone mad at the death of my first wife, and I had gone absolutely mad, and they locked me up in an institution in Southern California. But I talk about Fresno because I was absolutely irrevocably beaten. I had lost everything one more time, and I'd have a cycle of doing that. I knew there was no way out for me. I'd lost my business. I'd lost my company. I'd lost my friends. I lost whatever self-respect. I lost all ambition. My kids were not nice. And the relationship that I had with my lady had gone to hell. And I could see no sense in anything, and I was willing to check out, but I couldn't pull the plug, because that's how my first wife died. And I knew I couldn't do that. And I was condemned to live, and I didn't want to. And my lady patched me up, as a good Al-Anon might be. This is 9 years before I got here. One of the things that I'd have to tell you, that I am one of the most fortunate people on the face of this earth, as far as I'm concerned, in the sense that I did marry a black belt Al-Anon. But I had some great deal of participation in her creation. In this sense, that she has been, I'm convinced, absolutely convinced, was born in Al-Anon, raised in Al-Anon, and I entered into her life in a way that's indeed miraculous, and caused her to reach total fulfillment. Because at the age of 26, she had a boy and a girl and was a gay divorcee, when gay meant having fun. And I was a widower with five little girls. And when you dump on a 26-year-old woman, an alcoholic, and seven kids, you've got to have an Al-Anon or a nut. And fortunately for me, I had a crazy Al-Anon. One of the things that is so vital and important to me, not only about sobriety, but is the means by which I was given sobriety. I teach because I was taught, and that's all I have to offer, is what I was taught and what is contained in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, is what is called terms and conditions. At least that's, you see, they didn't teach me very nicely, because I was and perhaps still am, a very arrogant, stubborn individual. I did not want to learn some of the things that I had to learn. They taught me that if you want this thing, when it comes down to the 12 steps of recovery, if you want this thing and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then and then only are you ready to take these steps. And they asked me to find out what any lengths was. And one of the things that I had to do is read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous to start to find out those things that were required of me. Because if I am to stay here, you see, all of my life, I have been, whatever it was that I have tried to do, I needed to know how to do it before I would try. I needed to know the rules. And nobody ever gave me a handbook on how to do life. And when I came here, you told me, here's your handbook of sobriety, to show you precisely how we recovered is the main purpose of the book. And clear-cut directions, and you started giving me terms and conditions, and you asked me to make some positive decisions. I have run my life on the basis of, I know. Yeah, that's right, I believe in that. And they said, it doesn't cut in sobriety. It doesn't work at all. You're going to have to make some positive decisions. And nobody's going to make them for you. You yourself are going to make them. And you don't even have to do a goddamn thing about this thing unless you want it. Because that's what it says. If you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. And one of the things that I had to come to grips with, the fact that I was willing to walk in here with the knowledge that I could stay sober for good and for all. And I had to become aware that that's what I was going to achieve. And I was going to do that, of course, on a life that was based on living it one day at a time. That was my commitment. That was not an acknowledgement or somebody told me. That was the soul searching, that intense efforts that I committed myself to on my own. It said that a choose between an alcoholic death and a spiritual way of life is not an easy alternative. I did not want to die an alcoholic death. My father died an alcoholic death. I did not want to fall dead in front of my family, in the living room, like my father did. I didn't want to see my children grow up the way they were growing up, just like my father's children grow up, knowing full well he's nothing but a goddamn lush. I didn't want to die that way. And they gave me no alternative. You told me that I must live a spiritual way of life, and it was a conscious decision that I had to make. A spiritual way of life. And I made that decision. I knew that I was making this decision, and then I would have to go out and try and live it. You told me that in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it said that God is everything, He is nothing. He either is or He isn't, and you cut me no slack, and I didn't even believe in this God that you were talking about. You said I had to adopt a life based upon the fact that God was everything or nothing. And I had to choose. He either was or He wasn't, and you cut me no slack. And I had to make my decision. I did not have a God, but I had to make sure that I made the decision because you told me I must. And so I did make that decision because I would much prefer to live in a world that God was everything than in that empty void, that black pit of hell that I came from. And so I made that decision. And one of the decisions that you asked me to make is you told me that I must. I couldn't stay here unless I was willing to grasp and develop a manner of living that demanded rigorous honesty. Grasp, and I had to look it up in the dictionary, and when I looked it up, I got the definition that grasping was holding on firmly. And then I wanted to look up developing, because you see, everything I've got is invested in my program of recovery. My life, my future, and my sanity. It's the only departments of life I've got. My life, my future, and sanity is invested in this program. And if I'm going to invest that much into this thing, I damn well better know what it is that I'm to do. And it says I must grasp and develop was the gradual process of improvement. A manner of living. I had to live the program that demanded rigorous honesty. I defined honesty then and now as freedom from self-deception. And I got to thinking about that, because here it is that I'm involved in a fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The whole object of this program is, first of all, not to drink. But the byproduct of that not drinking and working these 12 steps is we become good people. It's a terrifying prospect. Because I don't mind being good. And when I want you to know that, I don't mind you knowing that. But I don't want you to think I'm good. There's a story that I heard that I would share with you, because it is, to me, so vitally important. It's a cornerstone of some of my very basic beliefs. And it says, this is a story, and I guess it's supposed to be a joke, but no one has ever laughed. So it is not a joke, it is a story. This is a story about some people that are out of town. There's three guys, they're on a convention, and they're out of town. Now, if you've ever been out of town on a convention, you know what happened. It's wine, women, and song, and hell raising, and that sort of stuff. And these people are out of town, and there are three of them, and they're sitting in a saloon. And there's a saloon has a coffee shop, and they're sitting there drinking coffee. And they're trying to explain to each other why it is that they're sitting in this room. and everybody else is out raising hell. And they decided, they looked at one guy and said, why are you here? And the man said, well, you see, I just had a heart attack. And the doctor has told me that I can't go around carousing, and I have to do a right amount of exercise, eat regularly, and go to bed and get a good night's sleep. And he said, as soon as I finish my coffee, I'm going to do just that. I'm going to go to sleep. And the other two thought that was a hell of a good idea. And they could understand why he was in this room. And they turned to the second guy and he said, how come you're in this room drinking coffee? And he said, well, he says, I just found out a few months ago that I'm an alcoholic and I can't drink. So I don't dare go where those other people are going and raising hell because I don't have enough program that I don't feel safe in those places. So I'm going to stay here and drink my coffee because I know I'm not going to get drunk drinking coffee. And the other two guys thought that, hell, that's a good deal. We can really understand why you're in this room. And they turned to the third guy. They said, how come you're in this room? And this man said, oh, well, I always try to do the right thing. Why is it that I've told that story many times and I still hate that son of a bitch? Can you imagine anybody that you know of that would have enough guts to say, oh, I always try to do the right thing? I found out that there is an inherent fear in most people of being caught being good. I have found, and it is my experience, that you will question the person standing at the podium who has the good life, and you won't question the one that's in misery. And I think that we have a false sense of illusion here because the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has designed, its whole purpose is for us to become good. It says in the 12 by 12, in step 6, it says most of us are willing to settle for just enough perfection as is necessary to get by in life, according to our perception as to what is necessary to get by in life. And I have come to the conclusion that the object of life might possibly be being good for nothing, for no reason whatsoever, just because it is my nature to be good. As a child of a loving Creator, being good for nothing seems to be a fine goal to strive for, and that is what I am about to. That is what I think you are about to. And since the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous has suggested very strongly that we have ceased fighting anything and anyone, it would be prudent to recognize that unless you're careful, and if you work this 12 steps of recovery, and if you don't watch out, you might get good for nothing. And I think that's a good thing, because it is the way it is, and it's the way it should be. It says in the Fellowship, and in a Big Book, it says that we absolutely insist on enjoying life. I did not know that I could come here and by a mere change of my life or a change of my thinking could suddenly start to enjoy life. One of the first tools you gave to me when I got here was Rule 62. Not to take myself so damn seriously. I did not know I could not. I did not know you could have joy just by breathing. You know, I came home to my wife one day, and it was just the most outrageous feeling I was having. I was a few months sober, and I just had this most outrageous feeling. And I come running up to Peg and said, girl, I feel strange. And she said, well, what do you mean you feel strange? I said, I feel strange. And she said, well, what do you feel, good or bad? I said, it feels good, but I don't have any reason to feel good. Because I've always felt that you had to have a reason to feel good. You had to do this, you had to get that and everything else. And I said, but I don't have any reason to feel good. She said, well, what would you do with the emotion? What would you call it? And I said, God, the only thing I could call it is impending good. And I believe that that is what sobriety is all about, impending good. Absolutely insisting on enjoying life. This I know, that it says that I get to absolutely enjoy life. the fellowship we have here at Saturday Night Live specifically was intended to do that. We wanted to learn how to live life and do things that we have never been able to do before and have fun without drinking. Life is a celebration. Alcoholics Anonymous is a celebration. Tonight is a celebration. We are celebrating sobriety. I am so grateful to be here. I am so grateful that your love was so much, so intense, so magnificent that it would reach out and grab me, someone who could not find you by himself. And what a debt of gratitude I have to you that I will never be able to repay. But by God, I'm going to make a run out of it. So let's go on with this celebration and have the birthday celebration. And thank you very much.